Thank you, Gail, and thanks to Design Build Live and to Crude Awakening for hosting me here, and thank you all for coming. I went back to the land in the age of entitlement. And if you don't think we're in the age of entitlement, you're reading a different set of tea leaves than I am. I got on the plane this morning, and a 20-something-year-old woman sat down beside me, talking on her multi-function digital device. We used to call those phones. But now it has a whole bunch of things. She's wearing her painted-on jeans, freshly painted on that morning, I could tell. Boots that go right up to her knees. Talking on the phone, complaining about how this is the worst day of her life. It's the worst day of my life. I can only hear her side of the conversation, right? Her purse, by the way, cost more than my plane ticket. She's talking on the phone, it's the worst day of my life. I got caught in traffic. It took me 15 minutes to get to the airport. I didn't even have time to stop at Starbucks to get a latte. And then you experience the miracle of flight, is that right? You got to sit there in a chair in the air, flying? I spend the whole flight these days going, whee! Right, because I can't believe it. She went from Phoenix to Austin in a time that used to take 3 or 4 months. You'd end up in the location with a different set of people than you started with. Along the way, Donner Party of One. Right? There's all kinds of challenges along the way. So this is the age of entitlement. I quit my full professor job, for which I was seriously overpaid and seriously underworked, about 2 years ago to go back to the land. And I did that for 3 reasons. One, as a sign of resistance against empire. When I talk about that to 20-year-olds, they give me a blank look. Resistance? Isn't that for terrorists? Or do you mean the video game? Two, because I'm pretty sure the industrial economy will complete its long overdue collapse within a relatively short period of time. I wouldn't mind being alive within the next few years. And three, because I think there's a moral imperative to the way we live our lives. So before I start, I need to apologize. I was traveling a little bit a couple of weeks ago. I got this horrible case of laryngitis, bronchitis. I was silent for 4 days. My wife loved that, by the way. So I'll be hacking and coughing my way through this, and I apologize in advance. Also, I generally try to adhere to 3 criteria when I speak. I try to be brief, I try to be funny, and I try to be brief. And apparently listening to me is like gargling razor blades, so there goes brief. And I'm going to be talking about the extinction of our species and the collapse of the industrial economy. That's, you know, roll on the floor funny, right? And I'm a professor at heart, so I profess. It's what I do. So my clock is set at 50 minutes. I'm lucky if I'll stop then. So there goes all 3 criteria.
Excuse me. Mm-hmm. Is there any reason why you're not using the mic?
He is using the mic.
Oh, my God.
Okay.
There's no sound system, is that right?
No, there's not.
There's no. Would you like me to speak louder?
Yeah, you're fine. Go ahead.
She has a hard time.
Most people have a hard time hearing my message, as it turns out. So I'll try to be as loud as I can. But my voice might go at some point. In fact, if I just collapse over sideways, that's your indication that it's okay to leave. I'll be going through this mountain of information relatively quickly. It won't seem like it's fast to you, but it will be. So it's going to be hard to keep up. I have a blog called Nature Bats Last. It's at guymcpherson.com. This talk will be posted there in some form within the next week or so. So if you go there for all this information about climate assessments, for example, that are going to fly by, you'll be able to catch up in a week or so whenever I get this posted. So I do want to talk about durable living. I want to talk about how we as individuals, as small groups, as communities can plan for climate change, which is ongoing, and energy decline, which is having the expected impacts with respect to the industrial economy. So I'm going to talk about global climate change, a situation for which is dire. I always talk about the bad news first, because it's so horribly, awfully bad that whatever I say next, you go, whew, that's great. So a bomb's going to go off in 13 minutes. Oh, finally, he's done. My focus on durable living arrangements will be on two of what I call the big four. I'm going to ignore water and body temperature and focus on the two that I think Austin has some chance of mitigating for instead of giving continually bad news. We're clearly in the stages of climate chaos at this point. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change in late 2007 came out with their fourth assessment and forecast, using an incredibly conservative approach, that we were committed to a 1 degree C global average temperature increase by the end of this century. At the time, we had experienced 3/4 of that 1 degree already. For simply elucidating the obvious, the IPCC was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. Well, half of it. Climate crusader Al Gore got the other half. A year later, the Hadley Center for Meteorological Research comes along, and there's more data available now, and the models are more sophisticated. And they say, actually, we're committed to 2 degrees C by the end of the century. Doesn't sound so bad, except that almost anybody who studies climate change knows that 2 degrees C really means we've crossed a series of thresholds beyond which we probably can't stop runaway climate change. 2 degrees C probably means 6 degrees C. And 6 degrees C means, well, the last time that happened on this planet, we had snakes the size of yellow school buses living in the tropical regions. And the largest mammal on the planet was the size of a shrew, because that's the largest mammal that can thermoregulate at 6 degrees warmer than it is right here, right now. So 2 degrees C is a big deal. In addition, these assessments do not take into account positive feedbacks. We know there are a number of feedbacks that will positively impact the rate of climate change. Things like release of methane hydrates or methane clathrates from the deep sea. Things like releasing all that carbon from the peat in the world's boreal forests. Things like reduced albedo as we melt all the Arctic and Antarctic ice. So those three positive feedbacks are not accounted for by any of these assessments I'm going to talk about today. So the situation is far more dire than I'm going to reveal. All of these assessments are way too conservative. United Nations Environment Program comes out 6 months after the Hadley Center's assessment and says, we're committed to 3.5 degrees C by 2100. That almost certainly puts the last nail into the coffin in terms of human habitation on this planet. Hadley Center for Meteorological Research comes along about a year after the previous assessment and says 4 is the new 2, but it's coming by mid-century. Global Carbon Project and Copenhagen Diagnosis, coincident with the Copenhagen meetings in which Barack Obama and the other leaders of the industrialized world threw the entire world under the bus, as it were, come up with 6 degrees C and 7 degrees C respectively by 2100, which is completely consistent with 4 degrees C by mid-century. International Energy Agency, about 2 months ago, came out with their latest assessment, which is 3.5 degrees C by 2035. That's 25 years from now. The bad news is none of those positive feedbacks are accounted for. The good news is there is one negative feedback that is not accounted for that might be sufficient to reduce climate change enough to save habitat for our species. That's complete collapse of the industrial economy of the world. United Nations Environment Program says 6.4 degrees C by 2050, which is, again, consistent with 3.5 degrees C by 2035. So we're headed for dire days, and here in the southwestern United States, we're headed right now into a 60-year drought. This according to the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science in an article published last month.